There's a common misconception that Miami-Dade is a melting pot. We are not a melting pot. I say we are far more akin to a TV dinner where sometimes the peas fall over into the mashed potatoes, but we are not, we do not mix well. We don't. We create these fiefdoms based on race, based on nation of origin. Everybody outside of Miami just thinks Hispanic or Latino.
Right.
It's like, no, hell no. I gotta tell you, being a white man in America, I won the genetic lottery. I could just shut the fuck up and be a much more successful and wealthy man than I am now. I don't have the stomach for it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I don't have the stomach to just sort of like see injustice and just be like, I'm good with that because mm-hmm. me and mine are equal. I don't think that putting your head in the sand and pretending that everything is just hunky-dory is helpful. And so I'm going to use my bully pulpit, you know, to speak truth to power. And that means shining a spotlight on what's fucked up and what's broken.
Hello, everyone. I'm super excited to be here with Billy Corbin, one of the most notable and entertaining Miami-bred professional storytellers, producers, and entrepreneurs. Thank you again, Billy, for taking the time to sit down with me. I have been a fan of your work since I first saw Cocaine Cowboys and, of course, 30 for 30 The U. Huge U fan. And then I started following you on IG. And the Because Florida and Because Miami are my favorite hashtags, and I want to get into that later. So I always get a chuckle out of your tongue-in-cheek posts. So we finally got a chance to meet, or actually I kind of stalked him at the Stars premiere of the Warriors of Liberty City a few months ago. So
great show.
Yes. We have an opportunity to sit down and learn a little bit more about your backstory. The premise of this show is to discuss some of the challenges that successful entrepreneurs such as yourself had to overcome to kind of give our listeners, as corny as it sounds, some inspiration and hope to see how we can overcome.
Or that we create for ourselves. The obstacles that we create for ourselves, yeah. Like my Twitter feed, for example, would be an obstacle I create for myself.
Which is absolutely hilarious.
Oh, okay. Then it's worth it.
It's totally worth it. So, yes, Billy, show off some of your Miami-isms. What schools did you go to here?
Oh, yeah, I went to Highland Oaks Elementary School, Highland Oaks Middle School, in part for my junior high years. And then I went to New World School of the Arts High School in downtown Miami, where my claim to fame was I was the only person who would drive Terrell McCraney home to Liberty City. Terrell McCraney, of course, is the Academy Award-winning co-writer of Moonlight, and that was my claim to fame. And I don't know that I necessarily remembered that until he told me that story many, many years later, that I was the only one who would drive him back. I guess everybody else was like, my parents don't let me drive into that neighborhood.
That.
And I drove everywhere in those days. Because when you go to a magnet school, like New World School of the Arts is, which is a performing arts high school modeled after the High School for the Performing Arts in New York, which is famous, of course, for the movie and TV show Fame. That's where the high school was based on.
Okay.
And so they have different disciplines, music, theater, dance, visual arts, and you have to audition to get in. And then there was 420, 30, 40, 50 people in the whole school. That's 9th through 12th. So individual classes, I mean, total classes, 9th through 12th, they each had maybe 100. And I think I graduated in a class of 104, 105 students.
Right.
So yeah, really competitive, really small. It's still a public school, Miami-Dade County Public School, but you're dual enrolled in Miami-Dade, at the time was Community College. It had two C's in those days.
Okay.
Miami-Dade Community College, now Miami-Dade College. And so, because it's a magnet school, it's open to students all over the county.
Mm-hmm.
Miami-Dade County, big county, one of the largest school systems in the country. And so I had friends now from all over the county.
Right.
Which really, because when you go to your home school, you know, it's neighborhood. Like, I rode my bike to elementary school and to middle school. So it's all neighborhood kids, you know. So, you don't really get outside your bubble or your universe. Yeah. So this was exciting because, like, suddenly it opened up the map for me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I suddenly started checking on my checklist of municipalities in Miami-Dade County. I've been everywhere. I've been to Hialeah. I've been to Pinecrest. I've been to West Bryan. I've been to Liberty City. Some of those aren't municipalities, but just neighborhoods that I otherwise would not have found myself in, because suddenly I had friends from school who were coming from all over. I went on the metro rail for the first time, you know, down to Dadeland, you know. And then there were places from my childhood that were only illuminated on my map of Miami-Dade because we had gone there. My grandparents loved the Chinese restaurant Canton when it was in Coral Gables, so we'd go there. I'd been to San Jacinto Forest. I'd been to the Falls once as a kid. But when you're not driving, like, you don't, the whole map isn't illuminated.
Right.
It's just that one spot. So all of a sudden, I started connecting dots, like, oh, like, I went to this comic book store on Bird Road when I was a kid. Now, all of a sudden, like, my friend Liz lives over there from high school. And, like, all of a sudden, the whole world, like, opened up. It was, you know, I dated a girl who lived in Pinecrest. I didn't, you know, I was like, what the hell is Pinecrest? Like, oh, there's the Falls. I've been to the Falls
there's
before.
Your frame of reference.
Yeah, so
okay.
It was like Legend of Zelda. I don't know if you remember the old school Nintendo. Old school NES. I'm talking about original Nintendo. Nintendo OG. Like, there was the map. And as you travel to different parts of it, it would literally illuminate. The whole map was, like, kind of darkish, and then it would, like, the different pods would, like, illuminate. That's what, like, Miami-Dade was like for me. All of a sudden, there was, like, all these pods illuminated, but then I'd start to connect the dots, and suddenly the whole map just lit up for me. And I was just like, it's a pretty interesting place. And then, of course, more and more municipalities started to form. We now have 34, mm-hmm. and you start to get to know this or understand the kind of tribal nature of a community like this, because, you know, I always say that there's a common misconception that Miami-Dade is a melting pot. We are not a melting pot. I say we are far more akin to a TV dinner where sometimes the peas fall over into the mashed potatoes, but we are not, we do not mix well. We don't. We have these, we create these fiefdoms based on race, based on nation of origin. Everybody outside of Miami just thinks Hispanic or Latino.
Right.
It's like, no, hell no. Like, that's, you know, and statistically, you know, there are polls, you know, Hispanic and Latin people hate being called Hispanic or Latin people. They want to be identified by their,
right.
and rightfully so, their nation of origin.
Right.
They're not Hispanic, they're Puerto Rican. They're not Latin, they're Cuban. They're Dominican. They're, you know, yeah, they're Spanish-speaking countries, but they're, you know, the Spanish is a little bit different, and their, you know, cultures are different, and people take a lot of pride in that. You can't fault them for that, but then it creates a sort of a system of self-segregation where I say it's like Game of Thrones in paradise with fewer dragons.
I like that, Billy. So what did you study at New World?
I was a ballerina. No,
okay,
I'm just kidding. I was in the what we call the straight theater division.
Okay.
I say straight theater because it was musical theater and then there was straight theater. So I was not in musical theater. I was in what we called straight theater or just theater.
So you're obviously a very witty and creative guy. And
is it obvious?
It's very obvious. From your social media, just interacting with you, this nonsense.
There are mayors who would disagree with you, but
we're going to get into that. I'm excited to get into that because I feel like Billy can say certain things that I just don't have the guts to say.
Let me be your inner monologue. I'll be the little devil on your shoulder.
Yes, the angel on my shoulder. So how did you transition from theater to such a talented filmmaker? And you said theater, right?
Yeah. But
so were you?
I was always interested in. I was a child actor when I was a kid,
okay.
and that's what really got me interested in that. I was not athletically inclined. My brother was a very gifted athlete when
okay.
we were kids. I was not. My claim to fame in athletics was that I struck out my first at bat at the NMB Optimist T-ball league, and that's that.
Congratulations.
That's the end of that.
Okay.
I mean, you know, T-ball. The ball's on a stick.
Yeah.
You just
got to
hit
right.
the ball on
it's
the stick.
It's not moving.
Yeah. And by the way, if you hit the tee, it's a strike. That doesn't count. You have to hit the ball.
So after that, you just decided, let me just.
I was like, I'm not cut out for this. Yeah.
Okay.
So I had a friend who was doing TV commercials in Miami in the 80s. It was like a lot of that kind of work down here. What they call modeling work or commercial work or catalog work. And then there was TV shows, a lot of TV shows and movies down here at the time. It's not like that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But back then, there was a ton of stuff. Agencies and photographers and casting directors. It was exciting. And so there was a woman, she's a woman now.
Okay.
But she was a little girl I saw on TV riding a bicycle in a Sears commercial. I thought that was the coolest thing in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I want to do that. And my parents were, like, ridiculously supportive people. They, like, my brother wanted to, you know, sports was his after-school activity. This became my,
okay.
going out on auditions and stuff became my after-school activity. So I went on auditions and I was just booking left and right. I did a commercial for just about everything you can imagine. You name a product sector.
As a talent.
As a kid, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you name
that.
A product sector, I did it. Cereal, sandwich meats, fast food, detergent, toys, you
okay.
name it, and I was in a bank, like, you name it, and I was in a commercial for it. And then started to do film and television stuff. Ron Howard,
okay.
also a recovering child actor himself, came to Florida to do the movie Parenthood. Came out in 89. We shot it in 88, predominantly in Orlando, in what Universal had not been built yet as a theme park, but they did have some studios on the lot. The whole theory was to make it like this is a working movie studio, just like the original theme park out west in the Studio City was. So here it was like kind of like, let's move a bunch, let's do a bunch of stuff here. They did Psycho 4. They did a bunch of Nickelodeon shows. They did a new Leave It to Beaver. Then they did Parenthood. Like, they wanted to be like, oh, it's a movie studio, and now we're building a theme park. And it was kind of the other way around in real life, but they came casting for that, and I got a speaking role in Parenthood. I'm the kid who curses at the birthday party in Parenthood, and that's what I claimed to fame there.
Okay.
Yeah, and then we started going out to L.A., started to do a pilot every year, some great guest spots and movie roles, so it was cool. And then when I hit 15, 16 years old, like every year my parents would be like, are you done yet? Like, have you grown out of this yet?
It was a phase.
Right, thinking it was a phase.
Right.
And, like, my brother, you know, playing sports, or, like, you know, you take kids to dance class or whatever you do, and then they, like, they're over it.
Right.
You know, like, so I grew out of it eventually. And I was like, you know what, I want to retire. It was, like, 15, you know.
Okay.
I was like, I want to retire, and I want to, none of those shows that I did a pilot for got picked up. you only do one pilot a year, and then, in fact, the last two pilots I did, Hilary Swank was in both of them.
Okay, so
I was in
both.
Yeah, but no, but more importantly, those shows didn't get picked up. Otherwise, I probably would have ruined our careers, if you think about it. We'd have been stuck on some shitty show. We might be a whole hell of a lot richer now, but, like, we would not have had the careers that, you know, she wouldn't have won two Oscars. I wouldn't have gone to Sundance, you know. So it was after that I came home. I really wanted to go to Normal High School, but I turned out to go to New World, which is anything but
normal.
A Normal High School. It's a very special, very unique, very important place that inexplicably struggles for funding every single year. And I think it's difficult for me to put it in perspective. I think it takes a real writer to do that. And Terrell McCraney says, in no uncertain terms, New World School of the Arts saved my life. Meaning his life. I'm quoting him. Not my life, you know. But, you know, he was a gay African-American in Liberty City who had a hell of a time in middle school, you can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And New World, he says, saved his life. You know, because I remember, like, just nobody at New World, you know, we were so busy being kids, being artists, creating art, rehearsing for shows, doing art, music, whatever. No one had time for, yeah, it was still high school, don't get it twisted, but nobody had time to hate gay people or hate black people or hate, like, just because they were gay. Like, no, we had so much common ground. Yeah, we had so much common ground that it was like, that wasn't, and I'm not going to say, like, we didn't sort of organically create cliques amongst people who were, you know, I was friends with both of the Jewish kids at the school. Like, with you, like, there's no doubt that you definitely gravitate.
Right.
Yeah, that's an unfortunate natural tendency of humans.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody hated anybody else for no good reason.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you know, it was not that type of mentality at that school. Nobody gave a shit. We were all artists. Everybody assumed everybody was gay. Nobody, you know what I mean? Like, it didn't matter. Like, it didn't prevent us from doing anything that any of us wanted to do, which was spend time together, have fun together, make art together. So, I took it for granted. You know, I don't think I understood, because we just had that mentality.
Right.
That we just didn't care. I mean, like, people would come out as straight at our school. You know, I mean, like, you're like, you're straight?
You're like, what?
Escándalo. You know, who knew? You know, like, you know, like, it was like, but like, so, and I just didn't think that way. And in a weird way, it was almost, it did not quite prepare me for the real world in a way, because I had no idea how tough life is in the real world for some people, being a white male, you know? And so, like, I didn't realize, like, how, and for Terrell, even tougher in the African-American community, being a gay male. Like, I didn't really understand that, you know,
So it was somewhat of a shelter.
You were, in a way.
And then when you went home, clearly your parents were super supportive, and I was thinking, maybe liberal is not the word, but they let you drive all over by yourself.
I was a designated driver. I was terribly. I didn't start drinking until I was 21. I didn't do any. I tried pot for the first time just a few years ago.
Like, okay.
It was 420. I was in Denver. What was I going to do? Then the first year I went to Denver for 420, I was backstage at a Snoop concert. Did not smoke.
Oh.
First of all, you get secondhand stone backstage at this new concert in Denver,
Colorado.
But like, I didn't smoke. And, like, I came home and they were like, oh, did you try all the pot? And I was, you know, this is pre-Amendment 2 here and everything, you know. And I'm like, no, I don't smoke. And they're like, you went to Denver on 420 backstage at Snoop concert and you didn't smoke. And I was like, no. And they're like, it's like going to Italy.
And not eating
seeing the Pope. And not eating pizza or pasta.
Right.
And I'm like, oh, that's interesting. So the next time I went, I tried it. I didn't like it.
So, Billy, do you intentionally... Like I said, your mind is very creative. Do you try to intentionally go against the grain, or this is just innate in you?
Yes.
To the former.
I mean, it's a yes to your either-or question. I mean, I would say, first and foremost, I think, you know, I studied poli-sci at the University of Miami. I left that part out. I did go, I also went on to the U after New World School of the Arts. So I'm a product of the Miami-Dade County Public School System and a graduate of the University of Miami. So I'm a functioning illiterate, is what I'm trying to tell you. But irregardless, as we say in Miami, because we're illiterate. But I use it ironically. That's how I use it. So
okay.
I will tell you that I had a tendency. Poli-sci was my area of study because the plan was to have like a pre-law curriculum and possibly go into to become a lawyer. Which for many years following my graduation from University of Miami, my mother was disappointed. I think that I didn't pursue the law. But I will tell you that we were like, I wasn't on the debate team or anything like that, but we were very, I'll give you an example. David Sipkin sitting here is our partner at Racontour, who I've known for so long, our parents used to bathe us together. We were sophomores in high school. So, kidding. No, we literally nursery school, literally preschool.
Very cute.
Yes. And so we were working together on our first documentary. He graduated FSU because nobody's perfect. But it is the best, one of the best film schools in the country, and certainly the best film school in the state. So we went to FSU Film. I was very envious of only that, not Tallahassee, not Seminoles, but only the fact that it was a. Well, I was jealous also. They had a lot of Waffle Houses, and we didn't have any Waffle Houses
in that time.
Miami Gardens, right. That's right, Carroll City, and so We did this documentary called Raw Deal, A Question of Consent. It was our first doc. I took a leave of absence from UM to work on it. Dave was out of FSU. He moved to Gainesville because it was a UF story. It was about the alleged sexual assault of an exotic dancer at a fraternity house at the University of Florida in Gainesville. And so we moved there for a month and worked on this, and it was our first doc. We made the decision to work on it in January of 2000, and by January of 2001, we were premiering at the Sundance Film Festival. At the time, we were the youngest filmmakers in the history of the festival and the only ones from Miami. And part of the, it was about, I told you what it was about, but the entire night's events of this Big Brother, Little Brother, you know, frat mixer event where they hired these exotic dancers to perform. It was all captured on video, including the better part of what Lisa had alleged was her assault. And the videotape footage had been put into the public record by virtue of our sunshine laws here in the state of Florida, our very open government Chapter 119 public records laws. And It became a scandal and a cause celeb in Gainesville at the time. And so what we did was we pursued an investigation where we interviewed the woman, we interviewed some of the fraternity men, and then used the videotape footage, uncensored, to kind of tell the story.
Yeah.
Right. And so it was very scandalous. It was very controversial. And in fact, when we were putting it together, Devil's Advocate was the name of the game. It was the only way to make it fair and make it work. Mm-hmm. And the critical response was pretty outrageous, but by and large, I think The Scotsman, which when we went to the Edinburgh Film Festival, they called it a triumph of objective reporting. Because people watch the documentary and change their mind. Not only back and forth over the course of the documentary, but if they have multiple viewings of it, they'll leave with a different conclusion, for example. But that was, I think, the success of that experience, and it was because we were so argumentative with each other. In fact, Dave, over our Final Cut Pro editing system, we were using like version 1.0 of Final Cut Pro. It was a nightmare, by the way. The movie would literally get trapped on the computer, on the hard drives. But Dave took a piece of printer paper and a Sharpie, and he wrote this, that this became like the phrase of the movie, and he hung it over and said, "Welcome to the argument." And he hung it over the editing system because every time someone would come into the editing room, which, by the way, was my apartment, people, my grandpa would be visiting somebody, they'd watch 12 seconds of footage over my shoulder or over Dave's shoulder. And the next thing you know, for the next hour and a half, everybody's like screaming and yelling, throwing stuff around. Everybody was, and we were constantly challenging each other. And we're saying, if we put in this footage of Lisa saying this and this video footage, we have to put in this soundbite from the men saying, and
right.
so there was, and we would switch sides, so we were able to argue also, and we just kept each other fair, and we kept each other objective, and we kept the peace that way too. So in a way, we were sort of naturally inclined to, as you say, go against the grain, play devil's advocate. At the same time, it seems to be our natural inclination as well, meaning that like there's just a part of me, and I there are times at which I'll confess I wish I could suppress or exterminate it, but the idea that if you see hypocrisy mm-hmm. or unfairness or corruption or injustice, you got to put a spotlight on it. And our docs do that on a larger scale. Mm-hmm. I say larger scale because they take a long time to make sometimes,
right.
but Twitter lets you do it immediately. You know, or as Reverend Run said in Tanning of America, immediately, you know, so, and that creates a little bit more of a stir, arguably, because you're in
a
the mix,
bit
and
more.
People can reply,
right.
and the, some of the politicians and police chiefs and mayors, and they can reply in real time, and shit gets real, and real exciting, and I really enjoy that, and I think, but one of the keys, I think, you know, as and I've prescribed this theory for many years, Andrew Gillum kept calling out Donald Trump, like, at me, like, you talk shit about me, at me. You know, I got
to
hear from other people,
right.
you know, like,
talk
so
to me.
I'm big on that. I'm big on me. Like, if I'm going to call out an agency or a politician or a public figure, I'm going to at you because I want them to have the opportunity. I'm not talking about you behind your back. We're all adults here. It's like if you want to defend yourself, you want to chime in, you want to like, you know, like I want you to be able to. Some of them have thin skins that block you or whatever, but like, which is unconstitutional, by the way. Spoiler alert: unconstitutional.
Oh,
yes. If you are a public official using your account to disseminate information in your official capacity to your constituents or to the public, but that's been a lot of fun too, calling them out on that. But like, but my point is that like, I'm not doing it to rabble rouse. The number of people I hear about who don't feel like they have a voice.
Mm-hmm.
The number of people I hear about who feel like even if they do have a platform for the sake of their livelihood or their sanity or their safety, they feel they cannot utilize that platform. I don't know. It sounds hokey, and I hate saying it. Is it like a calling? Is it something that I just feel a responsibility to do? I feel like if people are going to say you matter, if Twitter is going to put that blue check by your name and give you some credibility, some validity, you got to try to use it for good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do I get it right every time? Nobody does. You know, but I think I get it right more often than I get it wrong. And more importantly, I feel like, you know, I was, you know,
It's more your truth, not necessarily right or wrong. I think, like you said, not many people have the courage, but they're so afraid of the repercussions that most
yes.
people just keep their mouths closed.
Yes.
And just either like your picture. I don't even want to like the picture because
yeah.
they're scared you're going to sit on the floor. So I was going to ask you, what are your thoughts?
I think the truth is arguably more important than my truth. That's what I try to strive for. I can do me. But that's different from like the truth. I try to
shed light on the truth.
The truth. I don't know that there's any such thing as
right,
that anymore. But like, I just, you know, that's the thing too, is that sometimes, you know, my truth I think is a beautiful thing to say for people who have unique experiences.
Mm-hmm.
But much like, you know, a term like fake news or something, it can be abused by people who are, you know, who want to say my truth could also be alternative facts.
That's
not okay.
That's
not okay. Yeah, I don't. I feel like the idea that there isn't a truth anymore is scary. And I think when people speak their truth or say I'm speaking my truth, they're speaking the truth, is what they're speaking of. People who are having, but people who are speaking the truth about their experiences in the world that maybe other people can't relate to. You can't just say, oh, that's your truth because you're LGBTQ
right.
or trans. That's your, it's not their truth. It's the truth.
Right.
It is the reality
right.
of their life and their world that we say that's not my truth only because it's my experience. But that's still
right.
the truth. It's still
like
the
that.
Truth.
Not your experience.
It's still, right.
still
but it's still the truth. And I don't want to belittle people's experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to, because that's, listen, it's real easy. I got to tell you, being a white man in America, I won the genetic lottery. I could just shut the fuck up and be a much more successful and wealthy man than I am now. I don't have the stomach for it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I don't have the stomach to just to just sort of sit like see injustice and just be like, I'm good with that because me and mine are eating. That's not what, then what's the point of this? This is a shared experience, this earth, you know, like we're all in this. Miami is a shared experience. We don't act that way. We don't, you know, I would say that's why they call it Miami. Everybody's so selfish. Right. It's not our Miami. It's my fucking Miami, you know, like, and that's how people drive. That's how people treat each other. There's no reason for that. I want to, you know, it's just like, why can't we just say like, yeah, we're all stuck here on the 836 together. You don't got to be an asshole without a turn signal, cut me off to get one car length ahead. Like, let's just chill out. We're all in this together, man. You know, like, why can't we just share this?
Then it wouldn't be Miami.
Ain't that the truth?
So, I feel like we are highly critical sometimes of our hometown, but I'm the type of person, if someone else was to say something negative about Miami and or Florida, I kind of get defensive. So
I can say that because I am a Miamian.
But
some of my best friends are Miamians. Right. My accountant is a Miamian. My lawyer is a Miamian.
I can say that. I was just curious though, Billy, because I always get a kick out of the highly critical nature of some of your commentary, and like you said, exposing the truth. But what are some of your favorite things about Miami?
Oh,
the good stuff. Besides I guess you could say the weather, but that's so, you know, cliche.
The comedian Jeff Ross, very famous for the roasts, the Friars Club and Comedy Central roasts. He said the name of his book and his slogan we only roast the ones we love. And I love to hear from people who are just like, you talk shit so much about, you hate Miami so much, why don't you just move? And I'm like, if this is your home, if this is what you love, if this is where you love, like, you should make it better. You should work to make it better. And I don't think that putting your head in the sand and pretending that everything is just hunky-dory is helpful. Are there more constructive ways of doing it? Maybe, but I don't think so. Because people try constructive ways of doing it and don't get anywhere. And so I'm going to use my bully pulpit, I call it my Billy pulpit.
Okay.
You know, to speak truth to power. And that means shining a spotlight on what's fucked up and what's broken. People like, you always talk shit. That's all you do is nay. It's like, well, read my Twitter. That's not true. Some of the stuff is fun. Some of the stuff is funny. Some of the stuff is promoting good businesses and good restaurants and good work that people are doing in the community. But it's not my job to promote tourism, to tell everybody that everything's
right.
Okay.
It's not economic development.
Right. That everything's safe. I'm not with the Downtown Development Authority. I'm not with Greater Miami and the beaches.
You're
I'm not putting on some.
Council.
Yeah. Some, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Bullshit. A propaganda nonsense about all this. This real estate is all money laundering. It's all flight capital. It's all artificially inflated, and it's all going to be underwater. And none of us can afford it, okay, who live here. That's the bottom line. I don't want to hear about the real estate market. The lights are off, but everybody's home. Well, nobody's living in half of these condos. Get out of here with this. Like, what are we going to – we're just telling each other that everything's okay. Get out of here. Like, that's not how you – Miami is – it's pretty broken. It's damaged, if not broken. And you don't fix it by going like, top 10 list of the best dim sum. First of all, I wish there was 10 good dim sum restaurants in Miami. There are not. I don't think there are 3 good dim sum restaurants in Miami. But anyway, there's a lot that I love Miami. I'll tell you one thing. I'm a Causeway kid. That's like Bridge and Tunnel in New York.
Okay.
I don't live in Miami Beach, but I work. Our office has been here forever.
Mm-hmm.
So I commute every day. I come from the mainland. I hit the causeway, and I drive to Miami Beach.
Okay.
And I'll be damned if that view does not take my breath away twice a day, on my way to work and on my way home. You just can't even fathom that there are people who live in landlocked cities. That's why Orlando doesn't make any sense. Who lives in a peninsula an hour away from the beach? That makes zero. That only Uncle Walt would have thought of something
right.
like that.
That's
you know? Yeah, it was. They gave him, are you kidding? They let him create his own government and his own city there because they're like, he wants this bullshit land? It's worthless. In the middle of a peninsula, everybody settles on the coast.
Right.
That's how humanity works. That's how trade works. That's how resources work. But like, I mean, that for one. I mean, there's a damn, I mean, we're freezing today. It's like 60, right. It's like 68 yeah. degrees outside, and we're like, we're pulling out the winter gear, you got the parka on, you know, listen, we never get to wear our leather jackets. We all have a leather jacket, we never get to wear it. Right, the boots, of course, yeah, like this, yeah. So it's like, we all look like we're in Sundance right now, and like, you know, fucking Park City, but like, so there's really good, I mean, those are two good reasons right there. You know, I think what I always say, it's like, if you want to ruin anything in Miami, just add people. You know how, like, you go, you're like, your favorite, like, this new bar open, it's real chill, it's quiet, like, it's like, cheap drinks, everybody, I go in there, and then all of a sudden people start hearing about it, right?
So what?
Okay. And you show up one day and you're like, this place sucks. Why? Because there's people in it.
Okay, so can you give us, like, what's your favorite bar? First of all, you told us offline that you love Sandus Enchanted Forest.
Who doesn't love San Francisco? Communists don't love San Francisco Enchanted Forest. Okay. That's who. No, I love it. It's just a Miami tradition. It's just a funny, that jingle. Come on, sing it.
I can't.
Santa's Enchanted Forest. Come to see the light that's the one. Come on. Like, it's a tradition. It's a tradition. Like, you gotta love it. You gotta love it in all its sleazy Santa glory.
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
You have to get your, what is it, the funnel cake.
Oh, hell yeah. Oh, I have it's a food tour. It's a culinary tour for
right.
me.
I have the food part.
Oh, yeah. They got these great fajitas here. They got the sausage. They got the mini cinnamon donuts. Then you got to do the carny food. You know, you got to do the cotton candy, the candy apples. They have Granny Smith candy apples. Oh, yeah. I'm all about that.
Very detailed food. In the ingredients.
Well, we used to, when I was a kid, we had the whole Santa's trip was mapped around the food, when we need breaks so we could ride the ride, because you don't want to get sick on the rides from all that food. So you've got to, like, plan. We would strategically plan, because the same vendors were always in the same spot year after year.
So you would map this out prior.
You know, right, what you do down the main lane going in. You know what you would get on the way out. Then you know what you hit in the main sort of arcade areas. And there was a real strategy. Then you got to know what days, like, you don't go on Friday, Saturday.
Right, you go like on a Wednesday or Tuesday. Right. It's crowded.
And where you go before winter break or after winter break, because remember, it's open like before Thanksgiving and then it's open after the new year. So you want to wait for the kids to go back to school so there's no winter break and the season passes or a turnout is low.
About as an adult.
I'm talking about strategy.
Like, right.
We're not talking about strategy.
Strategic. Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Talking about, you got to know how to do Santa's Enchanted Forest is what I'm saying. And it's a blast. It's fun. It's just fun.
I haven't been in years, but I'll go back.
It's fun. You're going to hate it and be like, what? What the hell is this idiot talking about? That's what you're going to do.
Okay, now I'm like somewhat stepping back now, because I really want to know how you jumped from, it's called
Raw Deal Equestrian Pizza.
Raw Deal Equestrian.
Have you seen it?
I have not.
I'll give you a DVD. You know what a DVD is? Feel like young people like you. Oh, is there really? You have, oh, yeah. Young people like you have never heard of that.
Yes, I'll use the DVD. But, okay, for someone who is listening, and they're like, Billy is super cool. Like, I want to be like Billy.
Nobody is this
thing. Right, they're thinking this. What? I mean, because it just seems like you don't just up and go to New World, then you go to Gainesville for a couple of months, get all these accolades. How did you get to where you are now? I know that's such a broad question, but, like, your stories are amazing, and we keep going on these different cool tangents. But, like, what advice would you give someone, particularly now when they have, we were talking about social media, you can, there's everything from, obviously, old school YouTube to now even IGTV. The barriers of entry are a lot lower now for you to have a platform or an audience. So what would you tell, a 17-year-old Billy in the making?
Stay in school.
What? Okay.
I mean, I would say they have a lot more opportunities than we ever had as kids. Like, it was tough to, you know, so in terms of access to equipment or, you know, just cameras and the ability to do post-production, the ability to distribute, to get an audience. Like, now, the kids have the most powerful tool in the history of the world in their pockets. You know, and with great power comes great, great responsibility. Yeah. But they have the ability to shoot with the best camera I could have ever dreamed of having when we were kids. They can edit, they can publish internationally, worldwide, from these mobile devices, which is kind of petrifying, but very empowering. And I think that I think that it has led to some significant damage, this presidency being no small part of it. But I think it's also contributed to the potential for great justice and to illuminate injustice. I think the Black Lives Matter movement is owes a lot to this technology and the ubiquity of cameras, not just cell phone cameras, but body cameras and surveillance cameras and dash cams, and the ubiquity of this of cameras has had its, you know, we've certainly lost some privacy, but at the same time, it is illuminated. We have seen violence and we have seen injustice in a way that we would
never
have the opportunity to. And it makes it impossible to dismiss. Whereas we could have said before,
that's
your truth.
Right, I was going to say, that's your truth.
That's your truth. My experience with the police as a white man in America has been delightful. That's your truth.
Right.
It's the truth. And that's what video has helped illuminate. And when I talk to kids, particularly elementary school kids, most of them, not all of them, have cell phones. I don't care how much money their parents make or what. Everybody seems to have this technology.
Yeah.
It's really remarkable. So, I just try to distill them. Like, you are now a filmmaker. You are now a journalist. You are now a documentarian. What you do is you write what you know, is what they say. So you film what you know, and you tell the stories that you know. You tell the stories around you in your world. You tell the stories of your friends. You tell the stories of your family. Access is very important.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would say, you know, our job as filmmakers is to find a good story and don't fuck it up. Or the PG version is find a good story and tell it well. You know, and that's true predominantly, I'd say, of nonfiction filmmakers and journalists, but it's also true of, you know, we want to find a good script and then not fuck it up, you know, in dramatic filmmaking or storytelling. But like, so, and then I say how you do that. That's easier said than done, you know, find a good story and tell it well. So I apply this process. It's not foolproof, but it is idiot proof. I call it RAS, and that stands for relevance, access, style. So relevance. Okay, I got this idea for a documentary, right? Everybody comes up to Billy. I've got the idea for the greatest documentary ever made. Okay, what is it? Question one is R, relevance.
Mm-hmm.
Who gives a shit? If documentaries tend to be an extraordinary amount of work, a lot of dedication of, you know, blood, sweat, tears, sweat equity, somebody's money, maybe yours, maybe somebody else's. Either way, it's a real investment.
Mm-hmm.
It can take years sometimes to make a documentary. Usually minimum 1 year to make a documentary, but that's 1 year of your life on this earth, which is limited, you know? So in order to say, am I going to dedicate my time, energy, and resources to this, relevant. Is there going to be an audience at the end of this? Is somebody going to care about this enough to want to watch it? Some artists do things for themselves and tell stories for themselves. That's all well and good. I don't prescribe to that philosophy. I make stuff so hopefully, knock wood, people will watch it.
Mm-hmm.
So I say, it doesn't have to be the math for the masses. It could be, you know, niche makes you rich, as they say. It could be a limited audience, but at least there you go into it knowing that there's somebody to watch who will be interested in watching this story if I do it right.
Right.
Relevance. And topical is different from relevance. So don't tell me like, oh, it's in the headlines. It's like, but people might get enough of that shit on the news. They might not want to pay or spend
it. They don't want to hear it.
Right.
Yeah.
A Black Lives Matter is a good, you know, we have a story about a documentary that we're working on about a young man who, a Colombian immigrant,
mm-hmm.
who was tasered to death by Miami Beach police back in August of 2013. A documentary we've been working on. Very powerful stuff. Really beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
His life is a really beautiful story. Obviously, his death is extraordinarily tragic and a massive injustice in the city of Miami Beach and Miami-Dade County. It's sad. At the end of your day, you want to come home from a day of, you know, being battered left and right on social media and by the news with all the horrible shit that's going on in the world, your own problems at work and in your life. You want to Netflix and chill.
Right.
Do you want to watch a documentary about that? It's tough. Like, listen, I got a queue of documentaries that I, quote, must watch, end quote, that I haven't gotten to yet because I just haven't been in the mood. Right.
Yeah.
I haven't been. I mean, like, I don't want to be in that headspace. Right. You're like, I'm in a good place now, or I want to put myself in a good
place.
Let me watch. I need to watch some dumb shit right now. Let me watch some dumb shit.
I don't want to think. I don't want to feel that sort of emotion.
Right. I won't be able to sleep. I'm like, I don't want to go to bed angry. Right. I don't want to step. I get that way. I really internalize this shit. And it makes me really, I can't lie in bed and go through Twitter. I'll be up all night not going through Twitter, but thinking about all the horrible shit I read on Twitter. So, like, I internalize it. I get really anxious about it. I can't, like, so every once in a while I got to step back, you know. So that's an interesting thing. Like, you have to tell, you know, the stories that you want to tell that relate to you, but you have to know, am I going to get, so that, but there's a way, there's a kind of, not a way around that, but a way to sort of seize that. So the second thing, A, is access. So we have relevance, access. Access is, you know, the saying, it's not what you know, it's who you know. So access to what? You name it. Mm-hmm. Access to equipment, access to money, access to talent. You know, maybe you need a shooter to film for you. You need access to, you know, locations, access to, depending on what you're doing, costumes, scripts, access to the people you need to interview, movie stars to be in your movie. Access, you name it. You like access, okay? Secret to life, you know? And then style. It's not what you say, but it's how you say it. And so how are you as a storyteller, as a filmmaker, going to apply some sort of – how are you going to tell this story in an inventive, exciting, entertaining way? That's kind of what I was saying, the workaround a little bit, or the finesse you can get into when you're dealing with a tragic situation, you're dealing with something that could be – that could come off as like an educational video or something a little bit too much. But yeah. You can work to make it a little more entertaining. You could work, you could finesse it to make it a little bit more, you know, we call our genre pop docs. Okay. That's what we call our genre.
So your brand doesn't seem very depressed. So you are going to go through with, you finished this documentary?
No, we're working.
You're
on
working
it. Yeah,
on
yeah,
it.
Yeah, we're working. We're in the middle of it.
Okay.
Yeah. And so part of the challenge has been talking about how to make, like, it's real easy to examine his death and turn it into a procedural about how the wheels of injustice start turning in police departments, in state attorney's offices. It's real, you know, that's easy to do. Mm-hmm. And we're going to do it. Make no mistake. But what's a little bit more challenging is to how to celebrate the life of an 18-year-old artist who lived a very short time but contributed a lot to the people that he knew and that he touched and through his art, through his personality. So that's part of the things, but not in a sad way, in a celebration of his life and his art. So really, to me, it's a story about an artist and a young man, a kid, who made an extraordinary impression in the very short amount of time that he was here. And we're going to try some, I'm going to try some different techniques and some animations and things and some recrees that we've never really done in this way before to kind of turn it into, there's a love story there too. It might be a tragic love story, but for you know, the first half, let's say, let's, even though you know what's going to happen, let's try to celebrate his life and his art. And his family and his friends who he touched in a way that makes you feel
not as good as you can,
and turn it into a sort of beautiful piece of entertainment that celebrates his life and isn't just one of these heavy kind of explorations of injustice, you know, like almost for it to be almost about his death secondary. That's the challenge. It's a challenge, yeah. So, but it's worth doing.
Do you have to get permission from people's families, or with documentaries you can just do whatever you,
I think it depends on the people, on the nature of the story.
Okay.
Does it involve public figures or people who were public figures? Is there a glut of material available through public records, and you know, were these kind of celebrated or high profile cases? There's a lot of this material belongs to the world. It's just a matter of who's going to reach out and grab it, and how are you going to tell it. Yeah, so, but a lot of it's, you know, not everything, a lot of it's free and clear. In the case of something like this, I don't think I would have done it without the blessing or participation of his sister, of his parents, of his friends. Like, you know, I wouldn't have done that in this case. It wouldn't have sat right, number one. And number two, you can't really tell it, you know, the emotional connection to connect with the audience. Right, you need them.
Yeah.
You just need them. So I wouldn't have done it without that particular story. I wouldn't have done it without them.
Some of the others.
Well, some
it just seems like, which I think is absolutely hilarious.
What?
For example, the screwball.
Yeah, the screwball.
I mean,
it's all right.
The film.
Yes.
Named Screwball.
Sorry.
That was something you were able to do without the subject.
Well, no, we have the two primary subjects. And remember, it's not about A-Rod. A-Rod was certainly the most high-profile client of this guy.
Okay,
but it's really about this fake doctor and his client who wound up being the whistleblower who took the records to Tim Elfrink at the Miami New Times who put the whole thing on blast. But ultimately, A-Rod is a supporting character in their story.
He's high profile. So he was the
highest paid baseball player in history. It effectively ended his career, this scandal. He's only in as much of it as he is of Screwball, which is not a lot, but he's only in as much of it as he is because, he fought his suspension. All the other players eventually took their lumps, you know. Some of them pushed back, but, like, eventually just said, all right, I'm not appealing this.
More damaging, too.
Yeah, so A-Rod is the one who, like, dragged it out by appealing it, and then, like, the whole ugly truth had to come out. Like, so he was only as big of a figure in the scandal he was because he dragged the damn thing out. Yeah, it was his due process rights under the CBA, you know, the contract between, you know, the players' union and the league. But he chose to exercise those rights
and
under false pretenses as well. He did not have a legitimate defense. He was guilty as the day is long. So basically he didn't really have a pot to piss in or a leg to stand in on there. But like, but he is very much a supporting player in that story.
Okay.
And he is very much, I don't think anyone will argue, a public figure. Arguably one of the most famous people in the world.
Right.
So that being said, he is fair game. We are not malicious. This is, even though it's a comedy, hence the title Screwball, it's kind of it's like a Coen Brothers, like, heist movie gone awry. You know, with these Keystone criminals, you know, bumbling and fumbling around, MLB investigators, all crooked. It's like a Carl Hiaasen or Elmore Leonard novel. It's just like, it's Florida fuckery is what it is. It's an only in Miami kind of sordid tale, you know? And so, to that end, he is very much a Florida man, A-Rod, or a Miami man, you know? And so he's got shady, you know,
like
it's a sunny place.
A sunny place.
For shady people. Like, that's who you surround yourself with if you spend your childhood as Alex did, in Miami. But, you know, so it's that kind of story. But despite that, it is, I will tell you, in the experience we've just had with it as a company, Alfred Spellman, David Sipkin, my producing partners at Raconteur, the most meticulously researched and fact-checked documentary we have ever made. We're meticulous about all of them, but this was, it's one that you look at and you're like, okay, this is all crazy bullshit. Like, it's funny, it's just, it's satire. It's
really back it up.
It is meticulous. Okay. And fortunately, when we premiered at the Toronto International Film Festival, that was our world premiere, some of the critics noticed. I noticed in some of the reviews, they're like, don't let it fool you. Don't get it twisted. The movie's funny and entertaining, but it is meticulous.
Okay.
And it is. And whether it's in the documentary, because we'll sometimes show you a funny scene, and then boom, there's the document that proves it. We'll show you a scene, and then we're incorporating into that scene that we're recreating all funny, actual photographs. And you'll see, oh shit, not only is this real, but it's so meticulously recreated that, like, the photographs look like they're part of the stuff that we recreated. So, it is, and we were, because we were doing it in that tongue-in-cheek way, we're like, we better get
make
this
sure we back
perfect. And we've heard from people who we didn't interview in the movie, who we interviewed off camera, off the record, so to speak, who only confirmed. This is both before we shot it, during we shot it, while we shot it, and after we shot it, who have only confirmed that virtually every line in this doc is a fact, is legit, it's contained under oath in some court document, or, you know, this was just, we worked our asses off on this one. I think it shows. I think it's our best work, just in terms of the quality and
the depth, you know, of research.
Yeah, I'm really happy with it.
Like you said, a minimum of 1 year to produce these things, the level of research and.
Yeah, and then you're,
and then
the lawyers get to it, you know, later on.
You're so meticulous in your work that it's kind of hard to go after for, I guess, defamation or something, right?
And the way I'd say we're getting better at it, because we've always been meticulous, but the way you get better at it is, you know, we work with Michael Donaldson's firm, who is a First Amendment fair use. He is an attorney who has built his practice around documentary filmmakers. Since the explosion, the sort of modern golden age of documentary filmmaking, he literally wrote the book. You can download it, PDF. Wrote the book on best practices for documentary filmmakers issues, dealing in fair use, dealing in, you know, in any sort of actions that people might want to take against you. That deals with music, that deals with footage, that deals with people's likenesses, people, you know, defamation issue. Like, they are meticulous. So since we started working with them, which has been for a lot of years now, we get better at it.
Okay.
I mean, we can kind of, we watch stuff the way we know that they watch stuff. And so we're like, oh, you know what they're going to say about
right,
this?
Right, so not even
you know,
waste our time going on that.
Right, they're like,
right.
Let's just be careful about, okay. Yeah, so we're a little more set. And then we'll go back and forth with them and they'll say, listen, you got to cut this down, you got to cut this out. What? They'll have questions. Mm-hmm. Can you back this up? Can
okay.
you, back, you know, and to that end, I believe Screwball was one of their, I can't speak for them, but one of their less complicated
right,
reviews, because
like, okay.
we were already so sensitive to it that we tried to do it as best as we could, and they were just like, you know, they're like, obviously they had their con. It was a very thorough review, but I felt like we didn't get as many notes from them as we normally do. Because we were really, and a lot of their questions, we were able to be like, oh, here's this document,
okay.
here's this transcript, and yet the other thing too is that one of the things we really go for is you go, and it's tough because, in federal cases, there's like pre-sentencing reports,
mm-hmm.
and they are confidential.
Okay.
Because oftentimes they will contain medical history and information that it's just not a part of the public record in a case, even though it's a court case.
Mm-hmm.
So this is someone who's been convicted or has pled guilty,
mm-hmm.
and now this is a thorough report that the federal, like, it's not the BOP, but it's like the federal probation people put together, and like,
okay.
they make certain recommendations about, like, based on a medical history, maybe they need to be in a facility with a stronger medical wing or whatever it may be. So they do this whole, but it also contains all the quote unquote facts of the case. And what facts mean is that they were allocated to, they were admitted to, they were found to be facts by a jury or a judge. So if that gives you, you can't always get them, but that's something you want to kind of go, because that is like, if this is in the piece, we got the facts, right. We got the facts straight, right. So, and then you look for transcripts everywhere you can. For example, I don't know where we got them. And if I remember, I won't tell you
okay.
where we got them, but I don't actually remember. But we got a hold of transcripts from the Major League Baseball's arbitration with Alex. And people were under oath, and people were, and we would go through and like, and if there was things, and that's how we could check the veracity of the claims that our interview subjects were making. Our interview subjects provided us with text messages and emails, and for some of them we use, some of them we don't, but more to the point, it was so that they could prove to us,
okay.
provide corroborating evidence, essentially, that what they were telling us in their interview was true, or else we
right,
wouldn't put it in the documentary.
Stick your neck out there and lose your credibility as a...
Now listen, there's still some stories that mm-hmm. they were in a room with one other person, and so there's the only
okay.
right. But even in some of those cases, we actually would go out and say, I'll give you a perfect example. Tony Bosch, who is the fake doctor in the story, he hates when he calls him that. Tony Bosch, the unlicensed physician.
Okay, I'd rather
say. One of his clients was Manny Ramirez, Dodgers slugger Manny Ramirez, and so he was his first VIP client. You would go on the road with him. He would be in a suite. Next, sometimes he said he would share a suite with him.
You have that in the, not the pilot, in the...
The clip?
The clip.
But
right.
I think...
Wasn't he?
Oh, there might have been.
The
they mentioned him. Yes, they did. But you
okay.
didn't see Baby Manny. There's a Baby
oh,
Manny as well, just before
baby.
That.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
You saw him. Yeah, they mentioned
okay.
Manny
okay.
in the context of A-Rod. Yeah. And so because Manny was his first, before A-Rod, Manny was his biggest client.
Mm-hmm.
And so Manny, Tony tells a story that Manny... didn't like to sleep alone. So he'd have a suite with twin beds. And
okay.
so Tony would like sleep in the other bed and would have to talk to him or tell him a bedtime story is what how Tony described it, in order for Manny to feel comfortable and fall asleep. And so we're like, that's hilarious, but we don't know if that's true. Now, mind you, we would have been comfortable, I think, with it either way, but we weren't. We decided we're going to go out and try to get... And we started to research. And sure enough, there are other accounts out there in the world. Some pretty obscure, like it wasn't just like Google that came up, but there were books where someone was interviewed.
Okay.
By, and there's a famous saying, Manny being Manny, because he's known to be an eccentric character.
Mm-hmm.
And this apparently was one of his eccentricities, was that he didn't like to sleep. He couldn't fall asleep if he was by himself in like a
And it
big,
couldn't be like a teddy bear.
Right. He needed like... And so I don't know that the bedtime story thing was necessarily well known, but it was very... The point is that some part of that was verified. And so we felt comfortable. That's the thing is that we, you know, and we're also dealing in this project with with not only high profile, but very wealthy
right.
and litigious people in Major League Baseball and A-Rod and these guys.
So society is so litigious now.
Of course.
But, yeah.
So we just want to be... We wanted to be careful.
I wanted to be accurate.
And we didn't want people to just dismiss this as some goofy comedy or work of satire. It is, by the way, a goofy comedy or work of satire. But, like, it all happened as far as we were able to verify and as far as our interview subjects told us.
Okay. I may have to charge this, but I'm
yes, fine.
So, Billy, you've talked about some of the individual challenges and the work that goes into producing one of your works. But can you just share, everyone always sees the highlight reel, no pun intended, of your life and your works. But what are some of the challenges that you would feel comfortable sharing that people may not know that you have to overcome, besides the backlash from some of your extremely candid thoughts on social media? But like, what things have you gone through, and here you are still shining with tons on the horizon? I want to hear about what's coming up next. That
it feels terribly, what's the term? Not uncouth. It feels like really selfish. No, it's a better word. I'm just not thinking of it. But like for me to like complain about challenges. Mm-hmm. I haven't like globally speaking, I haven't really known a lot of what I would characterize as challenges. Knowing what I've grown to learn about the world, you know, mm-hmm. and life and becoming, I think, surprisingly more empathetic in my old age rather than the other way. I feel people get more stuck in their ways and kind of dig in and protect their own. And I, the opposite has been true for me. I think it's also a product of being in Miami in a way. You get to know a lot of different people mm-hmm. from all over the world with a lot of very unique experiences, very different from your own. I said it earlier, I won the genetic mm-hmm. lottery being born a white man in America. Let's just be perfectly honest about this. You don't get to pick your parents.
Right.
I mean, you one day you open your eyes in this world, you look around, you got to take stock, and you got to play the hand you're dealt. You know, some people can overcome certain adversity, some people can't, but that's what it is. You know, I'm remiss to say that there are challenges. You know, driving to work every day in this town, man. You know, I mean, you know, so, and you know, as successful as I feel like we've been in our careers, you know, we don't always get to make whatever we want to make. You know, we don't just get shit greenlit or financed. You know, we got to go out in the world like everybody else does and pound the pavement and peddle our wares and do the song and dance and the dog and pony show and try to convince people that this is something that people want to see, that they should finance. But so like we have this, you know, we got to pitch like everybody else does. We got to sing for our supper. But like, how is that something to complain about? I make a living doing something that I love to do in America in 2019. Hashtag blessed. You know, I mean, what do I have to complain about? What challenges do I have? I got to make this movie instead of that movie this year. I'll make that movie next. And like, seriously, it feels very petty. I you get enough of my pettiness on Twitter when I bitch about. I'm still. I ordered lunch from Delivery Dudes on December 22nd. What day is it now? I'm still waiting for that shit to be delivered.
What?
I'm still waiting.
Wait, what restaurant? Maybe you don't want to even talk about.
Oh no, the restaurant. I love the restaurant. It's not their fault. Go Lucky. It's this empanada place on the road. It's delicious.
Okay.
And when I get my when I'm like itching for some Go Lucky, I need to get my Go Lucky on. And so they don't do their own in-house delivery. It's all an outside service. So we call delivery or order online from Delivery Dudes.
So
we're still waiting.
That's Billy's challenge.
We're still waiting.
And I'm
getting my empanadas.
Right, get
but this is talking about Miami problems, right?
Right.
I can't get my empanadas.
That's because of Miami.
Because of Miami.
Right. I know I'm skipping all over the place. How did that start? Because Florida.
Yeah, you know what? Well, because the Florida Man thing, we were early adopters to the whole Florida Man genre of Florida fuckery, you know, news stories, you know, and so I kind of wanted my own thing. You know what I mean? Like my own trademark kind of, you know, like every Florida man, Florida woman, like that kind of belongs to the world. Like because Florida, I just wanted, because Miami, but usually because Florida, like I just wanted to have my own thing. And it just seemed to be, you know, it's kind of right up there. Like people say, you know, Florida, go to Florida, you know, like that's, you know, like that's like.
I still think that's why Miami's a little state.
Yeah, I remember, I just the other day, I was DMing with Jemele Hill and I sent her this ridiculous story about the Florida Secretary of State that new governor Ron DeSantis had just appointed, who had dressed in blackface at a 2005 Halloween party, and you're like, and how could that get any worse? It's like, well, he was in drag and in blackface. Like, how did that get any worse? It was 2005, and on his shirt was written, like, Katrina victim.
Right.
So it's like, this is like, he found a way to make this all worse. And if you're just like, if you were feeling extra forgiving that day and be like, okay, well, and you're like, wait, what? Okay, right. Well, wait, what? You're like, okay, three strikes.
Right.
You're out, you know, so
this is
already a one strike you're out deal, but now you've managed to somehow take it two steps too far. But like, so, and her reply to me was, Florida, go to Florida.
Right.
That's it, you know, like, so it was kind of that, because Florida is just like, and it just kind of says everything you need to know about it. Everybody, that's an international kind of a language, I guess.
It's like, so Billy, would you ever run for office?
No, never. Absolutely not.
I figured you would say that, but I just, okay.
No, and it's not even never say never. It's absolutely not. I would never subject my family or friends to that. I suspect that most people who run for office at this point in this day and age are sociopaths, narcissists. There's some sort of break with reality. They put their own ambition ahead of their families. I'm not saying that's everyone. But it's starting to feel more and more like it, and that's an unfortunate situation. And by the way, some politicians blame people like me, because they say when you just talk shit about all the politicians, then good people don't want to run for office, because then they're going to have to handle the scrutiny. I'm like, if you don't want to handle the scrutiny,
then do right.
Then do right or don't do it, okay? Like, if you can't handle the heat, if you're going to have thin skin, Ken Russell, I'm sorry. If you're going to have thin skin, Francis Suarez, I'm sorry. If you're going to have thin skin, then you're in the wrong game. And if you know you're doing the right thing, then you ain't got to worry about little old me. Am I right? So if you know you're doing the right thing, you can go home and sleep at night. You don't have to worry about me shit tweeting or whatever, you know, you don't have to worry about me trolling or whatever you want to call it. Okay, you don't have to worry about me, right? They worry about me because they're not doing the right thing, and I call them out for it. They're worried about it because they know they're screwing up. They know they're crooked. They know they're inept. They know they're incompetent. And what they don't want is accountability or transparency. And, you know, sunny place for shady people. Government in the sunshine is what it's supposed to be, but we got government in the shade. And that is a problem. And I'm going to call it how I seize it.
And I think he's through the whole shade tree.
And I think I'm a pretty equal opportunity offender. I remember one day someone called me like, you're just attacking Kristen Rosen Gonzalez because she's a woman. I'm like, no, I'm attacking Kristen Rosen Gonzalez. First of all, I'm not attacking her. I'm speaking truth to power. She is in a position of power. She's an elected commissioner in the city of Miami Beach. She was running for Congress. I was like, I'm not attacking her. I'm calling her out, not because she is a woman, but because she is bad at what she does. Straight up. That's it. Okay? That's like saying I'm attacking, I'm going after Mayor Levine because he's Jewish. You know, I'm going after Mike Rico because he's a man. I'm going after Keon Hardeman because he's black. I'm going after Joe Carollo because he's Cuban, or Francis Suarez because he's Cuban, or Ken Russell because he's Japanese American. It's like, okay, so I just hate everybody? It's like, no, but like when you're in power, I don't care what, you know, who you are, where you come from. I got to tell you, I get a little, just personally, a little more frustrated when I see people in the minority communities being taken advantage of, because they're already an underserved and underrepresented population. And so when I see their representatives taking advantage. I'm like, well, that's that much less representation than, you know, I'm talking to you, Oliver Gilbert in Miami Gardens, you know? That's, you know, I'm talking to you, Keon Hardiman in City of Miami, you know? I mean, like, because then you already have a population that, especially in this community, Miami's a unique community for African Americans. By unique, I mean even shittier than normal. And the reason being is that it's a great American tradition to treat African Americans like second-class citizens. But you come to Miami, and we got the majority. We got the Cuban majority who have come in to their credit, built a city within a city. They are all – they are the power base,
right.
You know, the Cuban-American community. And, more, and props to them. I don't knock their hustle. But what has happened as a result is that you have the Cuban community, the Anglo community. I think we're the only place that calls our white – community Anglo, right?
Anglo minority.
Right. And then what happens, yes, we are the minority. But then that pushes the African Americans become third class citizens in that equation. And then Haitians become, oh my God, nobody looks after the Haitian community here. I mean, that's just a tragedy. And they contribute so much to this community with virtually zero representation, zero voice in our process. And so when you see that, you want somebody to stand up and someone to effectively represent those communities. And you know.
That's been my frustration. Like you said, though, I'm not 100% happy with the local, state, or national representation. But
you're on a tightrope here. You are.
However, but.
This is the most diplomatic language I've ever heard.
But you're right. It's like. Can I say this? We need, if we want new representation, but we already know how hostile the environment, not because of Billy. I think
in part,
not really. I like you said. I mean, you need thick skin if you're going to put yourself out there. Like, I mean, people can say whatever they want to say, especially when it's not baseless. But how do you? What would you suggest to try to just shift the entire? Let's just since we're Miami.
I didn't say it. Spike Lee said it. Do the right thing. The right thing. It's not that hard. Do the right thing.
Because the thing is, I sometimes find myself complaining, which I hate to be a complainer. I'm more of an actionable type of person.
Might be constructive, offer solutions.
What can I do besides criticize the people downtown and try to get fresh blood in? But like you said, anyone would be a narcissist to take that sort. I mean, what are we going to do? Like, just...
Oh, yeah, we're fucked. Yeah, we're fucked. I mean, but that's the thing, too, is that we have these so-called new generations of leadership coming in, and they are profoundly disappointing. Keon Hardiman, Ken Russell, Francis Suarez, these are supposed to be people that are coming in and representing our generation, you know, and they're young men,
right.
Essentially,
yeah.
You know. First of all, I'm pretty sure women are about 51% of the city of Miami. There's not a woman on that dais. There's barely a woman in a position of power within City Hall, barely. I say, a woman in power. Okay, you know what I call Miami City Hall? I call it the Belen East Campus is what I call it, okay? Because that's what it looks like, all right? And then they have Vicky Mendez, the city attorney, who should probably be in jail, okay? She shouldn't be the city attorney, okay? She should probably be in jail. Best thing Ken Russell ever did was try to get rid of her. So that's who we have in city government. Like, we, you know, it's not just that we need women. We need good women. We not just
right.
We need men or African Americans. We need good people. Good people who are going to do the right thing, regardless of their gender or their race or whatever. And that is a real challenge. And I got to tell you, I don't know. I pray on. I'm not a praying man, and I pray
right.
on this
pray on
often.
And it's beyond just good. We need visionaries. I think we're lacking at the county and the city level.
Yeah, there's no
There's no vision. I felt like there's so much potential in Miami, and it's just.
No, these guys are just living high rise to high rise, you know, groundbreaking to groundbreaking, selling off our public parks to private interests. Like, these are hustlers. These are straight hustlers. These are con men, you know. And you have to remember, Miami, you know, this is not a factory town. We have no indigenous industry other than selling the sunshine. We sell the dream. We rely solely on outside revenue coming in, tourists, flight capital in our real estate. It's a hustle.
Mm-hmm.
We subsist from hustle to hustle. And that's not a real – that's a Ponzi scheme. That's a Ponzi scheme. If outside revenue stopped coming in, what would happen to – we're not a self-sustaining economy. We don't do any – we don't – well, you know, as Carl Hyacin says, we don't produce anything in Florida other than oranges and machine guns. That's all we make here. We sell sunshine. We sell the Florida dream. We sell bullshit. That's what we sell here.
And cocaine.
We sell, well, that's, yeah, but that's not even our product. That's important.
That's important.
We're only on a wholesale retail level there. We're not even on a manufacturing level here on cocaine. You know, so that's what I'm saying. We're like, what if that stopped coming in? That could crater the whole sector of the economy.
Right. Yeah. You can't just sit around it.
Right. So what I'm saying is that's how these politicians exist. They have warped priorities and perverse incentives. They measure progress by the number of construction cranes they can count on the horizon. Okay, by the amount of money that they can give to billionaire developers or sports team owners, okay, to ruin our traffic, to ruin our public property, to steal our public property with sports stadium hustles. That's all we have here. So they don't have, I say they have warped priorities because that's how they measure success. The perverse incentives they have is they're not negotiating with their money. They're negotiating with our money. Okay, and our property, the people's property, and they make pretend like it's there. Let me tell you a story about Miami-Dade Commissioner Audrey Edmondson. I was waiting for you to exhale. I have a feeling you might not for about 45 minutes. Let me tell you something about, she was being interviewed a couple years back. You might remember the scandal, so to speak, about Parcel B reopened. Parcel B is this little lot of land. It's not little, but it's a sliver of land between the American Airlines Arena and the bay. Mm-hmm. And it was part of the 1996-ish referendum on the Miami Heat lease on the American Airlines Arena. And in that deal, they promised contractually, since 1996, I graduated from high school, they promised that they would turn Parcel B into a public park, a park for all to enjoy. So we must have got some wires crossed or something, because what they did was they made it a parking lot for their valet parking.
Completely
pretty close. And so what happened was is that when shit started to heat up a few years back in Bicentennial Park, they were talking about the Cuban Museum. There was a lot of stuff going on. Some activists went back there, and they discovered that Parcel B not only was not a developed public park, but there was a chain link fence and a lock on it. And they discovered that Miami Heat had put a fence up and put a lock up on public property. Okay, built a fence and put their own lock on it and had been using it for free, basically, for their valet parking lot. Okay, and here we are, it's still 2019, and spoiler alert, they ain't built the park yet. But a few years ago when this first broke, Audrey Edmondson, who I believe her district in the county includes that area, was being asked, was being interviewed, and the interviewer brought up Parcel B. And Audrey Edmondson went into this whole thing about Miami Heat. I'm a home team girl. I love the home team. I love the Miami Heat. This, incidentally, are owned by billionaire Mickey Arison, whose family owns Carnival Cruise Line and the Miami Heat, and is a very big power player in terms of political contributions. Also, to be fair, philanthropy, and we have them in no small part to thank for the Adrian Arsht Center, which was originally called the Carnival Center, but they were good enough to actually yield to Adrian when she came to bail the place out. And so, shout out to them. The bottom line is they owe us a park. And Audrey's take was, Commissioner Edmondson's take was, I love the Heat, go Heat, I'm a hometown, I always root for the home team. And so the reporter asked, well, what about your constituents, though? And what, and what they were promised. And Commissioner Edmondson said, I hadn't thought about it that way before. And let me tell you what's so compelling about that. I'll let it simmer for a second. Let it settle. Is that she had been in government so long. And if you have never been to government center or really seen how any of this works, you have no idea. This is a bubble. It's a world within a world. Their world is not their constituents. It's lobbyists and special interests who wine and dine and come to meetings with them. You have to see, they're not necessarily, even when they're out and about, they're not really there, engaged, knowing what you're doing. It's a photo op. So their world is people telling them what to think and how to vote, and those people are giving them money, and they're negotiating.
It's the donation list.
Yeah, absolutely, and they're negotiating with our money, but they're also getting essentially a kickback through, campaign contributions, through gifts, through dinner, through whatever, through the stature of being able to pose with David Beckham or take selfies with, with D-Wade grade or whatever it may be. They get their access. It raises their profile. They get money and they give these people whatever they want, these special interests. But her thinking had become so warped that she had and admitted, had a lack of self-awareness to essentially admit that I hadn't thought about my constituents.
That actually come out of...
Well, because what a moment of clarity for her that may have been. It would have been for, you know, what a moment, like a Bulworth moment of like, oh, what have I done with my life? What have I done with my ideals? What have I done with why did I get into this racket in the first place? Presumably it was to help people. Presumably it was to represent your constituents. But even if, so let's assume that, let me give them the benefit of the doubt, a lot of these, but let's assume it started there. The corrosion, dare I say corruption of the mind and the mentality is such that by the time you're that embedded in the weeds, in the muck, her first thought was to jump to the defense of her billionaire campaign contributor. Not, what about my constituents who, right. That, and then when confronted with a very simple follow up, yeah, but what about the people who voted for you to be in office? She was like, how about that? So to me, and that's not just Commissioner Edmondson, that anecdote involves her. That is an insight into the mentality of all of these politicians. It is about them. Okay? It is about them. There is no I in election, okay? There is. But it's really, really sad. And when you say, where is the hope? What is the answer? Where are the potential solutions? How can we be constructive about this? We just need to elect better people. Then it becomes your question. How do you get better people to run? I am now becoming proactive this year. I'm kind of breaking a little bit of news here. I am out in the world looking to, for lack of a better term, recruit better people to run for office. I think really try it in one, maybe two elections this year as just kind of a pilot program. See how it goes. Win or lose, I think I'll continue to be involved or get more involved. But, you know, sort of doing what you need to do to kind of recruit good people. Go out in the community, find those people. Find people who hadn't thought about running before, because it's the people who have thought about it or who have acted on it.
You're not a narcissist.
Right.
But that's the people that you recruit.
The thing is that, like, the people who actually do it voluntarily are the folks you want to be scared of. Who, you know, basically, you know, like this Howard Schultz, this Starbucks putz, like this guy, you know. So
I think we have to clean house. It's hard to attract and recruit when you have to sit on the deal.
For a lot of these offices, state and local, we do have term limits. The one thing I agree with Rick Scott on is that there should be term limits in Congress, in the Senate, in the House. I agree with that. I don't think they should be too short, though, because you do have people who become experts in the government. Is hard. Governing is hard. Mm-hmm. The logistics of governing are hard. I mean, you can see what Nancy Pelosi is running circles around this, you know, around this idiot, because she knows how government works and he just doesn't. So, like, when you know how it works, and so there is something to be said for wisdom and experience, right. And in any other line of work, you say, oh, I want people who know what they're doing. So you can't just recycle
over
people in government,
right.
All that. Then you're going to wind up with, every time you're going to wind up with novices and people who don't know what the hell is going on. Yeah, it'll be a mess. So you got to find a way to temper that, I think, and to balance that out.
I'm excited about you going out.
Yeah. I'm
recruiting.
Yeah, so I would, like, yeah. I said, I would never run. It's not my thing. But I for the first time in the last
10 years?
Year or two,
oh,
I would say. Okay. Year two or three, I have started to more openly endorse candidates to little or no effect, but
right. Okay. See, the last person you endorsed for governor,
I endorsed Andrew Gillum.
I haven't seen you endorse any commissioners, county or city.
I have. I endorsed Eileen Higgins.
Oh,
who won?
Yeah,
I endorsed almost entirely, to be fair, Democrats running for House in 2018, mm-hmm. and for both the U.S. House of Representatives and the state of Florida, except for Michael Grieco. I did not endorse Michael Grieco because he's a criminal. who lied to everybody and attempted to cover up illegal campaign contributions from a foreign millionaire. So not MAGA. He's not MAGA-ing, okay? He's a criminal who should be in prison, but because of the ineffectiveness of our state attorney, he's now in Tallahassee as a state rep. And that is, in the word of Hillary Clinton, deplorable. He's a Democrat, but I don't care. You're deplorable, you're deplorable. I don't care. I don't discriminate.
I feel like it's the basis of the person.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, bless his heart, he thought, like, I'm a white man, nothing can stop me. And he was right, as it turns out. Murica. Is that 280 characters or less? Can I tweet that? Hey, I'm going to tweet that. I'm going to add him. In fact, Michael Grieco, that criminal, and also state representative, but also a criminal. Objectively a criminal. I don't mean like, oh, what he did was a crime. I mean, like, literally illegal, against the law, should be in prison, but for the fact that Kathy Fernandez-Rundle is either too corrupt or incompetent to do her job effectively. And as a result, Miami-Dade County is basically, forget sea level rise, we are sinking into the bay under the weight of our own public corruption, to tell you the truth, because we don't have a top cop who takes that job seriously. You know, she goes after and prosecutes people like former Miami Commissioner Michelle Spence Jones, who she had, Kathy Rundle had exculpatory evidence exonerating her of one of the cases, one of the charges, sitting in two file boxes, and still charged her with a crime that she had the evidence and then turned it over to the defense in discovery, and they go, wait, what about this piece of paper? Who are like, oh, my bad, drop those charges, and then go to trial and other charges for which she's acquitted. Like, that's a legitimate public corruption case in this town. It's pathetic. And Kathy Fernandez-Rundle, 25 years in office. She is the only state attorney, the only top prosecutor we have had in this county since Janet Reno left for the Clinton administration.
Quarter century.
That's correct. And in a quarter century, Kathy Fernandez-Rundle has never charged a police officer for an on-duty killing. Not once. And that's not because it doesn't happen. And that's not because it has happened less. It is actually, despite the fact that crime is down, the incidence of use of force and specifically on-duty killings have proliferated in this county. And Kathy Fernandez-Rundle has not done a thing about it. And that basically means impunity. That sends a signal to every police officer that knows that I can get away with murder, potentially.
Literally.
Or literally. And that has created a toxic environment of mistrust, of division, that has threatened the safety of good police officers, that has threatened the safety of innocent people in this community, mm-hmm. that has actually led to legitimate criminals, not just police officers who break law, but legitimate criminals going free when they arrest innocent people, for example, because of bad police work or corrupt police work. And then what happens? The real perpetrators of those crimes go free, mm-hmm. which means no justice for the families of the victims or the victims themselves. I mean, this is the state attorney's office that has catered that in injustice, and it has done unspeakable damage to this community, and it's distressing because, you know, she is the top cop. She sets the tone, and the message has been loud and clear that public corruption, if you want to know how it has, why it has thrived and blossomed, you've got to look. Police commissioner, police chiefs come and go. Mayors come and go, some of them. Commissioners come and go. People come, you know, all things change. If you want to know what's wrong with something, you look at the constants. She's been here for 25 years as the top cop. You want to know what's wrong in Miami-Dade County, that's what's wrong. And I've been saying it for 10 years. It's only recently become popular to say it, I think in no small part because of the rise of the what they call a so-called SJWs, the social justice warriors, as if that's such a bad thing to strive or fight for social justice. How that became a derisive term, like civil rights became a derisive term, Black Lives Matter is a derisive term. It's crazy, but you know, that's where we're at in this. And if you want to know how we can fix it, for starters, and other communities are doing this now, we can elect a new state attorney.
Right, and I was going to say, I'm please go and pick.
I voted for Rod Vereen. He won't run again. Okay. Ron won't run again.
Well, at the commission level. I'm
yeah,
really excited about that.
Oh, so, it should be fun. It should be fun. We'd like to change the makeup of it a little bit. Make it a little bit more representative of the community.
Great.
Ooh, poquito. Just a little bit. Just a little bit.
Wow, see, okay. Well, Billy, I'm going to end this on something more lighthearted.
No, God.
Because remember we said that, for example, after a long day, we don't want to be thinking about things that are going to put
too late. I'm going to be up all night. Thinking about all this crazy shit.
Wait, before you tell us about your other project that you already told me about, I want to ask you a fun question.
Okay.
Let's see. Okay. If you were given a 1 minute Super Bowl slot and you couldn't sell it, what would you fill it with?
Truth. There was a one word. If this were a one word, do I get 280 characters or how many?
Or actually, okay, fine. That's
yeah. There's not. I mean, you saw this year that CBS rejected a medical marijuana ad that was done in documentary style with a child who suffers from, you know, dozens if not hundreds of seizures a day, and the only thing that works is is cannabis, and not smokable marijuana, but the oil and the the other forms, and they rejected it. This is a sick child suffering from seizures all the time. You can imagine the state of these parents, just emotionally and physically and financially, and CBS rejected it. You know, so for start, I'd like to start with anything that the network would reject.
I would start there,
but that's the thing, is they reject truth. You know, they'll lie to people about how they should drink lots of beer and eat lots of Doritos, and spoiler alert, not good. If you want to know why Americans are fatter than ever, it's because food is garbage.
Not even
yeah, it's not even food. Mm-hmm. You know, so they'll fill the airwaves with lies because that pays. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, if you give me 60 seconds, I'd tell the truth. The problem is that, as my grandfather once told me, very philanthropical man, he said, Billy, one of my greatest regrets is that I didn't make more money so that I could give more money away, because there are so many important causes that need funding and attention, and so I would just have to, I'd have to pick from my litany of truth bombs,
but you're
and
so
pick
awesome.
Which one to drop
I
on the
story. I think that yeah. you can get this
yeah, I'd have to, I'd have to pick from my litany of truth bombs and figure out which one to drop on Super Bowl Sunday. No Black Sunday. I did not intend that was, you know, the movie Black Sunday, the Thomas Harris book, about them dropping a bomb on the Orange Bowl at the Super Bowl. I didn't mean like that.
Not
kind
like
of,
that.
I meant a truth bomb.
Okay.
I meant a truth bomb. Yeah.
That's
but like, no, but like, for sure, I think that's a great example. The fact that CBS rejected that ad this year. I mean, if you said I get that time, I'd be like, fuck you. This is the ad that I'm going to show. I'm going to specifically go for the one that you. Now, listen, there might be good reasons to reject things for content, for, you know, like, yeah, I wouldn't put nudity or drug use or something like that on Super Bowl Sunday. But I think that truth needs to be told, that there are sick children, and that there are. I bet they wouldn't have rejected a big pharma ad about some crazy, crazy ass, dangerous, addictive, deadly drug you should put your kids on. But here's the only thing that helps this horrifically sick child, and we're gonna be like, no thanks. Next, so that's what this year. That's what I would do.
Okay.
MAGA.
Okay, Billy, if people want more.
How could
Billy,
they possibly after that? They don't want less. This man is exhausted.
How can they get some more Billy?
This has been my exhaust Ted talk. That's what Billy Pulpit.
Billy Pulpit.
Billy Pulpit.
How can they get access to Billy Pulpit?
At Billy Corben. That's Corben. I'm not the lead singer of Smashing Pumpkins.
I was gonna
He's
ask.
At Billy.
So wait a minute. Your birth name is not Corben.
No, it's Cohen.
Cohen.
Yeah.
What happened?
Look,
you
actually,
added an extra curvature to, like, what happened?
We lied. someone misspelled it. They saw the H as like a B and they added an R.
No, it's not at all.
No, I mean, it's Googleable.
Okay.
Yeah, but like, but truth be told, it's kind of an interesting story that I don't know if I've ever told it, like, in a public forum, but when I was a child actor, I told you that earlier.
Right.
There were some experiences where My agent, my manager at the time, had felt that I was auditioning and I was kind of coming down to the last two kids.
Okay.
And I wasn't getting the job, and it would be for, like, Bo Bridges' son or something like that. And when you walk into a room and your name is Billy Cohen, it's a very Jewish last name, a very Jewish last name. There's, like, history of the Kohen, and I remember my rabbi, when I was being bar mitzvahed, went on this whole monologue. I was like, holy shit, rabbi, you know? And I was like, about the Kohen. And there's rules, like, at your bar mitzvah, if there is a Kohen giving an aliyah, they must be the first one. Like, it's crazy. There's, like, rules about this name. Like, so it's like, there's a lot of history, and there's a lot of religiousness. So like, and then, you know, so even if you go into a room and there'd be Jewish producers and Jewish directors, like, I remember, like, going to a room and somebody like, oh, Billy Cohen. Now you look at my picture, resume, like, Billy Cohen, nice Jewish boy. They said, totally harmless, like, not meaning anything by it. I didn't think anything of it until my agent manager said, listen, like, you're not exactly all American boy.
You have to water down.
Yeah, it was like some Ellis Island shit. Yeah, it was like, it was, yeah, so it, and I, like, I remember sitting in
Ellis Island.
Yeah, I mean, I remember sitting in the car with my mom and crying. I was 13 or 14 years old, and I was working all the time, so it wasn't like,
you weren't getting any, right,
like,
you were
getting, and I was kind of like, and I remember I said to her, I don't know, I was like, I'm not ashamed of,
right,
who I am. I'm not ashamed of my name. I'm not ashamed of my grandfather's name. I was named for my great grandfather. I was like, guys, like, I'm not, you know. So we did it with the idea of, and it was really at the end of my career, because I retired basically, like,
right, 15, because you were
2 or 3 years later, not even. Yeah, 2 years later. And so, like, so ultimately I didn't book any more gigs. Than I had with the fake name or whatever.
Right.
It's like,
okay.
Yeah, and so honestly, at that point, it kind of just stuck as like a professional name. And so I just, I mean, like, it's like now, it, like, it's weird. It's funny, if I was going to be a director, it's not like Steven Spielberg's been slowed down at all. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, you know, like,
I
no, what it's funny, it's like, if I'd just been a director, no one would have cared, you know?
I really thought it was just because you thought you went to add an R and the B was more, okay.
No.
So it has a real legitimate.
Yeah, and then my mom came up with it, it was pretty close, you know what I mean?
Okay.
And people thought I was in LA, I did a stint on LA Law at the time, and people thought it was because of Corbin Burnson.
Oh.
It wasn't because of that. And it's Corben, although everybody misspells it with an I. Yeah, so it just kind of stuck. There's times when I find it a little bit, I guess, annoying now. It's also kind of cool, though, like, I don't know, having an alias. You
right,
know, like, Madonna's not a real name. That's,
right,
you know,
like,
Charlie Sheen, that's not his real name.
Oh,
like, what I'm saying is, like, there's a tradition of that in showbiz, of not only, like, you know, like, it's not RuPaul, that's not,
right,
that, you know, it's not her name, or, you know, yeah, like, so, but what I'm saying, like, is, like, so there's a tradition of that, so it's kind of, like, whatever, but, like, there are times when I'm...
Want to go back.
I could go back. It's just like, it's
just be like Diddy, P. Diddy with Puff Daddy. Depends on what you
want. Yeah,
like,
I get,
maybe
right,
your new.
Maybe I'll just do Prince. Maybe I'll just be a symbol.
Right, you can just.
I'll just be a, I'll have a symbol.
Just do a symbol.
Name, yeah. I don't know, but it's interesting you asked that, and it was, and I think it was a sobering moment too.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't recall ever experiencing any anti-Semitism, professionally or personally or otherwise. So like, but it made me aware of it suddenly.
Mm-hmm.
Now I was just like, oh shit, you know,
this,
like,
maybe
this is a thing, yeah. And so it was a sobering experience for me. It was upsetting. It doesn't really upset me anymore. Sometimes it just annoys me.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, I got like an alias. It's kind of cool.
Right.
You know, I get to,
so
I get,
yeah,
so,
like,
nobody knows who Billy
right.
Cohen is, so if I don't want anybody to know
that's
who I am, yeah,
I'll
be like,
I mean,
yeah, and it's funny, like, sometimes people will recognize me and I'll give my ID or whatever, and they'll look at my license and they'll look at me, and they'll look at my license, they'll look at me, I'll be like, are you Billy Corbin? And I'll be like, are you a process server? And they'll be like, no, and I'm like, then yeah. And, you know, and then they'll be like, oh, because the ID is just
right.
Cohen or whatever. Yeah, it's, but like, now I just see it as fun.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Like, it allows me kind of a cool level of anonymity if that comes in handy. Or whatever.
And
I wouldn't lie to anybody about I am or I'm not.
Right.
I mean, it's just sort of like, you know, I don't know. It's
okay.
Kind of fun having, yeah.
Here.
I mean, like, you know,
yeah,
I mean, yeah, I was going to change my name to Flo Rida, but that was already taken.
Right, that was taken.
That was,
so,
you know.
I like the Corbin.
You're like my Amy or something.
It could,
I mean.
You know, 2020.
Yeah.
So anyway, your social media handles are all with your
at Billy Corbin, C-O-R-B-E-N. Yeah. It's my stage name. Yeah, at Billy Corbin is on Insta, on Facebook, on Twitter, which is where I spend most. I'm not a big Facebook guy. I'm more on Twitter, second on Instagram, and I'm kind of, it's like Facebook is the new Friendster for me.
I'm like, when my parents' friends are on Facebook.
I'm not even huge on Insta. I'm a big Twitter fan.
You're more of a Twitter.
It's a disease. It's a disease.
You have to follow him. Like, it's hilarious. It will brighten your day.
Or not.
Yeah. No, it brightens my day, no matter what. Reading the comments are my favorite part.
I'll tell you something. True story. We're doing this play, Confessions of a Cocaine Cowboy. And we made an offer to an actor that we were very excited about, but weren't sure if he would do it. Mm-hmm. Fingers crossed. We were just like praying, fingers crossed. We had a little Santeria ceremony. We spilled some chicken blood. I mean, we were really praying hard for this. And so next thing you know, I get this DM. Mm-hmm. From a woman who follows me on Instagram, who's like, you just made an offer to my client for your Cocaine Cowboys play. I'm so excited. I hope he does it. I was a varsity cheerleader at the University of Miami from 91 to 95. I think there's like a shot of me in archive footage in the U documentary. And she and I start going back and forth. We're like BFFs now all of a sudden. And she's like, and then her partner in the agency, the woman I was talking with was at Sundance. Her partner was in L.A. handling this negotiation. I wound up on the phone with her. She's like, is it true that you and my partner went to college together? I'm like, I might have been in the cheerleading squad with her. I was like, I may have been the guy. She jumped onto my shoulders from the top of the pyramid. She's like, that's not true. I'm like, she's a little before me. I'm like, I'm a little after her time. And we laughed about it. And she goes, let me tell you something. She reads and shows me your Because Florida and Because Miami posts all the time. And she goes, I didn't put it together that it was you and your show. When she put, she just knows me as like the Because Florida guy, right? And so I don't know that it's true. It's probably not true because obviously it was up to this actor whether or not he wanted to do the part. But I'm going to say, like, it's because of
the comment section.
Because Florida, yeah. It's because of the and so, like, now we're, like, it's really funny. Like, she's like, I'm going to come down to Miami, like, for the show. I'm like, come home, welcome home. Like, we're all excited. Like, and in a funny way, it was sort of like social media bringing strangers together through common experiences. And
your pettiness.
And,
like, honestly, your petty is unifying. I don't care what anyone has to say. Like, it's the best.
My petty is unifying. Yes. That's what I need.
My petty is unifying 20. What's the next election?
2020.
22, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm so serious.
My petty is unifying 2020. Yeah. Well, it's not quite as catchy as... In the words of a great statesman, your mama is pay to play. As Miami City Commissioner Keon Hardiman once tweeted me in reply to me when I referred to him as pay-to-play Keon. Anyway, he is making Miami great again. Too soon? Too late.
Please follow Corbin, Billy, at Billy Corbin. And Billy, before we sign off. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you were talking about the play.
Yes.
And then you have some other exciting things.
Yeah, a lot of stuff going on. Yeah, rehearsals have begun on the play, Confessions of a Cocaine Cowboy. Performances start Thursday, March 7th. Opening night is Saturday, March 16th. It runs through April 7th. Plays Thursday through Sunday, all those 5 weekends. You go to cocainecowboys.com. Tickets are already on sale, and they're actually selling pretty fast. So if you want to pick a date and pick a seat, now's the time, cocainecowboys.com. March 2nd at the Miami International Film Festival. This is a first for us. We have a raconteur double feature on Calle Ocho, actually, Tropic Cinema. They're going to be world premiering our new documentary, Magic City Hustle. This is about former UM athletes who went and became professional highlight players last year at Magic City Casino. It's pretty wild. It's pretty funny.
I wasn't expecting you to say that.
Spoiler alert, they're not very good because it's a really hard sport. And a sport that's played by little kids in Spain, like, literally, like, they're born and they put a cesta, they put that basket on their hand. So, and they play their whole lives before they become professionals. These guys put on a cesta for the first time in their lives in January of 2018. And in July of 2018, they were officially professional highlight players. It's hilarious. But it's also kind of wonderful. Like, it's, to me, it's like the U meets Broke meets Dogfight of our documentaries. And instead of backyard fighting, it's High Line. It's like an Only in Miami Hustle that you could just be like, one December you like get an email and it's like, hey, you a former UM athlete? Want to be a professional highlight player? Get health insurance, get dental insurance, make good money, have a chance at $400,000 in potential prize money. And a bunch of guys were like, hell yeah, I'm going to sell my ice cream trucks that I'm driving. I'm going to put down the hip hop music. I'm going to take a leave of absence from being a cop. I'm going to take a break from being an Uber driver. I'm going to take, like.
Wait, so these are young guys? I guess
they, you know, these are guys. No, I mean, these are guys. I mean, 30, I mean, some of them are in their 20s, but some of them,
they're
in their 40s. Some of them are up there, you know, and so it's an interesting, it's a real, like, you know, it's like Slapshot or Major League. That's, it's like this kind of ragtag team of guys who you're really rooting for, and they're just, I mean, they were world-class athletes back in the day in sports that they grew up playing.
Right.
Highlight American, it's a Spanish sport, you know, from the Basque region of Spain. The, you know, these guys grew up, as you do, play baseball, play football, play basketball. They don't, you know, track and field. They don't know from this Highline nonsense.
Wait, so like, how did this story come to you? Like, how do you find it? Who?
It was put on our radar by some UM, you know, former UM folks because of the U documentaries, and they said, maybe you want to come and follow this. And we're like, that'll be fun. And so we followed it for the whole season, 5 months last year. We just stopped shooting in December. We just finished shooting in December. So we're still, I mean, it's a quick turnaround time. So that world premieres March 2nd at the Miami International Film Festival. And the same night, the Miami premiere of Screwball, our documentary about A-Rod and the Biogenesis steroid scandal premieres. So I get to just sit in one spot, I think, in one theater at the Atropic and just chill. And so I think that's going to be a fun night.
Super.
And what else is going on? Is that all that's going on? I think that's all. I mean, like, there's other things like later in the year, but I mean, that's a lot of stuff going on. Like,
I have no idea what the hustle is about.
Like, Magic City Hustle. Yeah. So for these guys, because you know, it opens and they're doing all these different things, and you're like, what the hell is this all about?
And these are people that I've heard about.
Some of them you absolutely have heard of. I totally fucked up. It's the Tower Theater, the Tropic. That's actually a theater in Key West. So, I'll just take two. So March 2nd at the Miami International Film Festival at the Tower Theater in Cayo Show, we have, for the first time ever, we're really proud and excited about it, a raconteur double feature. So first is the world premiere of our new documentary, Magic City Hustle. And then immediately following that is the Miami premiere of our documentary Screwball, which we talked about earlier, which is the story of A-Rod and the Biogenesis steroid scandal. So that's March 2nd. I don't have a website. I'm sure it's like MiamiInternationalFilmFestival.com or something, or .org, or you'll find it.
Right.
Yeah. You know, but yeah, so between the play and Screwball and Magic City Hustle, it's a busy, you know, late winter, early spring, and it's going to be a busy rest of the year too. With a whole bunch of other stuff. But I really hope people come out and see this play. It's a wild ride for people who saw Cocaine Cowboys and remember Jorge Rivialla, the hitman, who worked for Griselda Blanco, La Madrina, the cocaine queenpin, the godmother of cocaine. Rivi, we interviewed extensively in Cocaine Cowboys, Cocaine Cowboys 2, and Cocaine Cowboys Reloaded. And we had not only the transcripts of our interviews with him, but the 1,000-plus page depositions that he gave in the state of Florida versus Griselda Blanco. That was our research material for the original documentary. And I remember reading it. I was a theater kid, you know, from New World, and I was reading it to prepare for an interview. And I'm like, wow, this would make an amazing, amazing play. And here we are 15 years later, and it is an amazing play. It is wild. I will tell you that if you've been seen live theater before, it's going to be wild. If you've never been to live theater before, but you know, are interested in the story or are fans of Cocaine Cowboys, it is going to be even more wild for you, because it's going to be, it's not a musical, okay, but it's okay. But it's, well, but it's wild though. It's a wild ride, and it's pretty crazy, you know. And it's and much like, you know, Cocaine Cowboys, the documentary wasn't just about cocaine.
Right.
It was about sort of the city of Miami and how the skyline was really built, arguably, on the narco dollars generated in that era. We had some pretty compelling contemporary parallels, you know, because at its root, Cocaine Cowboys, a documentary, is really about immigrants, children, and gun violence. And what could be more topical in 2019 than stories of immigrants, children, and gun violence? And that's a lot of it. And you might not think about it that way. If you go back and watch Cooking Cowboys now, you'll be like, oh, wow. Like, it's really
irrelevant.
It's a story of immigrants. It's a right. It's a story of children in harm's way and gun violence. And so it becomes suddenly a very relevant story to the 21st century. It's not just sort of this retrospective historical look at this wild and crazy time. It has a lot to say about serious shit to say about contemporary America. So it's been an incredible process. I co-wrote it with Oren Squire, who is another local boy made good from the Opa-locka. So speaking of crazy cities, crazy corrupt cities, the FBI literally raided City Hall. That's how corrupt Opa-locka is. That is nothing more than a criminal racketeering organization, and the victims are its residents. Let's be real about this. And the victims are the taxpayers of Miami-Dade County in the state of Florida, because they are stealing our water and they're stealing our utilities. It's a crazy place. But Oren survived Opa-locka and is now a very successful playwright. And I think like something like 30 plays under his belt. He was on the first season of the hit NBC show This Is Us, writing one of the crucial storylines. And I told him, I said, Oren, your job is to make white women cry. That's what you did on This Is Us. And he laughs. I was like, that was your job. He did like the African American family storyline in season one. And if you watch that show, I didn't, but I know a lot of white women who did. And all they did was just cry. Every time Sterling K. Brown came on screen, or his dad, and the dojo scene, I was like, Oren, you just make white women cry. That's what you do. And he just laughs. But he is really gifted. He is on the CBS show now, The Good Fight, which is the spinoff of, I think, The Good Wife. And so he's just like killing it killed it in L.A., killing it in New York, killing it now. And so we've just had a really, really fun time writing this show, often remotely. You know, we're on a Google Doc together. You know, so we've only been in the same room a handful of times, and usually not working, usually not writing, you know, just meeting or talking or working shit out. And then we've co-written remotely, and it's been a really interesting experience. And I think it was really important getting some other perspectives on it. We have this incredibly diverse cast, Colombian, Puerto Rican, Cuban, Nicaraguan, one Anglo, as Miami goes,
right.
The director is Venezuelan. Like, it's a super Miami production, and it's right here on Lincoln Road at the Colony Theater at Miami New Drama, which is an incredible, really like only 3 years old. But they're talking about killing it. They did the first ever trilingual production of Our Town. It was in English, Spanish, and Creole. It was extraordinary. I think it was the first time the playwright's estate ever allowed the play to be altered. It's such a sacred text that it's like, no, you gotta do it as is.
Right.
You can be creative with the sets, with this, with that, but like, you gotta do the text. And they allowed them to translate it into these other languages, and it was like, I call it Que Pasa Our Town. You know, it was like,
right,
Spanish and Creole,
right.
It was like, it was amazing, and it was so powerful and so moving, and suddenly Our Town became Miami, because, like, of the representation, and it wasn't just in those languages, there were, of course, Anglos, Hispanics,
yeah.
and Haitian actors in the story, so they're doing some amazing stuff there, and it's like, it always feels like super Miami, but multinational, because Miami is multinational.
Right.
So, you know, it's never homogenous. It's as close to a melting pot as I guess you can get in Miami, as far as it,
right.
You know, because even our entertainment options are like pretty divided. You know what I mean? Like, so the Cubans go here to party, African Americans go here for entertainment, white people go here for. So it's like, there's something for everybody, to be fair. But
right.
But there's, it's not that often that, like, you have come together and be like,
right,
I want
right,
to maybe
right.
Ultra. I don't know, maybe. That's mostly white people.
Yeah.
Yeah, what am I saying? So, what am I talking about? There's no diversity there. it's ultra white is what it is. It's like Oscar so white, it's ultra white. No, but this is a place where, you know, and I think I'm excited because so far, like the way the ticket sales are going, there's a lot of first time theater goers. You know, people who check that box that like, no, I have not been to the theater before. And that's because they're fans of Cocaine Cowboys or whatever, so they're coming to experience live theater for the first time. It's been 15 years since we started researching and working on it. Wow. The movie came out in 06, so it's been 13 years since the movie came out theatrically, 12 since people really started to see it on DVD. Bootleg dropped in 06, though. Summer 06 was the summer at the flea. At the flea. Oh, hell, at the Carol Mart? Oh, come on now. That's where it blew up.
Okay.
That's where, at the barber shops, and that's how it happened.
That's how Cocaine
Cowboys happened. That was inadvertent. People think we did it on purpose, and I wish we had.
Excellent marketing.
I wish we had. You know, mixtape style. I wish we had done that, but we didn't. It just happened viral. In those days, viral meant DVDRs. You know what I mean? The spindle. You remember the spindle? You remember the guy in the Walmart parking lot in the strip club bathroom with the book full of DVDRs?
Right.
The bootleg guy. Yeah, the bootleg guy. Everybody's got a bootleg guy. Before, like, torrents caught on and everybody was streaming and downloading, you had the bootleg guy. So the flea was like, it was a hot ticket at the DVDR at the flea. Yeah. That's how it started. That's how Cocaine Cowboys blew up.
But people can get it online now.
Yeah, I think it's on. I feel like it's on Hulu. I feel like it's streaming on Hulu now, and there's plenty of places where, I mean, let's be real, just download that shit. You're gonna go on YouTube or whatever. I mean, come on. You're gonna get it however you get it. You're gonna Google it, and however it comes up is how you're gonna get it. And listen, as long as people are watching, I'm cool. I always say, like, people go, oh, Cocaine Cowboys, that's a cult classic. I was like, yeah, you know what cult classic means? Well, they're like, what? I'm like, everybody's seen it, and we haven't made any money. I'm like, that's what cult classic means.
I'm getting it.
Yeah, cult classic.
Thank you very much, Billy.
Thank
this
you
was,
very much.
This was far more entertaining than I would have ever thought.
Oh, really? We should do this again.
We should. So, yes, I'm definitely...
Next time, drinks.
That's what I was going to say.
Then I'll tell you the truth.
I love
then I'll tell
my...
Oh, the cafecito here. Yeah, whatever we do, yeah.
But whenever you add some wine to
whiskey,
anything...
Whiskey.
You're a whiskey person?
You drink wine and whiskey. Wine and whiskey.
Wine and whiskey.
Yep.
W squared. It just makes the conversation that much more entertaining. But thanks again, and...
I think we did well sober. Soberish.
We did very well sober. Yeah. Wait, did you give your website? You already told them. They'll just Google.
Yeah, well, you come to twitter.com/ Billy Corbin, CORBEN, or instagram.com/ Billy Corbin, CORB. It's all at Billy Corbin, at Billy Corbin Director on Facebook, and cocainecowboys.com is where you can go right now. That takes you right to the site for the play, for Confessions of a Cocaine Cowboy. Raconteur.com, RAKONTUR, is our company site, where that's the latest news on all the shit that we're doing. And, you know, I appreciate you coming here and letting me promote my stuff and I really appreciate, we certainly always appreciate everybody watching it and hitting us up on Twitter, even if they're haters. You know, I love the haters, you know, but I can't abide the grammar. Like the grammar shit, I can't abide.
I love it.
I can't abide
correct
by the grammar. Like haters come at me, I'm good. But
if
just,
you're gonna hate, spell it right.
Right. I mean, like the president today wrote something about like you know, the intel chiefs need to go back to school because they're this and that. But he spelled they're wrong.
Without the
T H E R E instead of T H E I R. Yeah, like it doesn't surprise me. He's not only he's not only homophobic, he's homophonic too. All right, so.
Oh,
instantrimshot.com is my other website.
But, okay.
I mean, this is great.
This
Seriously,
okay.
This is a lot. Oh.